Welcome to the Iditarod, a podcast about what else? The Iditarod, a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio in Nome. I'm your host, Josh Edge. Wade Mars led Mushers into Ruby yesterday, but Mitch Seavey took charge in the run for Galena. But before we get into today's episode, here's a quick word from our sponsor.
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of fueling the 49th state, is proud to support Iditarod coverage on Alaska Public Media.
While Wade Mars may have been the first musher into Ruby, he opted to take a bit of a break, which we'll hear more about in a minute, and he surrendered the lead, for now at least, to others who decided to push on. Just a reminder, we are in the midst of producing our daily episodes, which we'll keep pushing out until the end of the race. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher, or listen on alaskapublic.org. As you should know by now, Zachariah Hughes from Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio's Ben Matheson are out on the trail right now doing things trail reporters do, like hopefully reporting from the trail. Back to the race. 350 miles into the trail, the leaderboard is filled with some familiar names. Mitch Seavey, Yor Leif Seth Olsom, Nicholas Petit, Pete Kaiser, Hugh Neff. But those names are likely to change pretty frequently for a while as mushers' rest strategies unfold and the real racing begins. Ben sent in a story overnight about this. Let's take a listen.
Willow musher Wade Mars arrived first into the checkpoint a little before 7 o'clock.
There's a lot of people out here. Am I the first one here?
Well, because all
you are.
Oh,
you are.
Wow. That's cool.
Mars quickly tells checkers that he's declaring his 24-hour rest. As the first musher to Ruby, Mars won the Pen Air Spirit of Alaska Award, which comes with a special print plus a handmade gift from Ruby residents. Mars pauses brief, and he sets off to take care of his chores. Mars quickly parks his team to settle in for the rest. He sets down beds of straw.
This is a nice straw.
And tosses out hunks of frozen salmon, which the team devours.
I mean, these guys are monsters. They're screaming coming up the hill. I mean, literally barking going down the trail. They're barking last night going down the trail and stuff. It's pretty awesome to see. I've never had a team this animated and amped up. But they're definitely seemed like they were just down a notch. On, not on attitude, definitely, but on, I don't know. They're down a notch on something.
Teams are now taking their 24-hour or 8-hour Yukon breaks as they leapfrog one another on opposing schedules. Mushers declare their breaks to checkers, but they don't commit to it and can leave if they want to. Mars was confident in his plan.
Hopefully it works out good. Yep. As long as Dallas does what I expect him to do, it'll work out really well.
That is, he's expecting Dallas to do the same as 2015, when he took his 8-hour break here, camped outside Galena, and did his 24 down the trail in Hooslea.
So, I gotta try to play his game on him and get a step ahead of him, which we are right now, which is perfect. So, now I just have to play my cards right.
46 minutes later, Dallas Seavey arrives in all black.
I'm going to declare 24.
Okay.
And I'm going to declare an 8. And I'm going to declare I'm indecisive. But right. Most likely 24.
Well,
we're planning on a 24.
Okay.
Seavey pulls out three resting dogs and sprints up and down the dog line doing chores. He throws down thin pieces of foam, camping pads, a novel addition to the straw piles used to keep dogs cozy. The stretch from Tanana to Ruby is the longest on the trail, nearly 120 miles. Along the way, both Seavey and Mars rested about 4 hours to break up the journey. After leaving Wednesday morning at 1 a.m., the two camped near each other for a morning rest. Hours later, they found themselves parked a few feet from one another in Ruby. That was close enough to swap race plans, or at least tentative race plans, as they worked along their dog lines.
You taking your 24?
I think so. Yeah. I think I am too.
What's that? I said, why not? It's cold out there.
Yeah. Both teams appear to be diverging from their 2015 strategies along the same route. Dallas's dad, Mitch Seavey, pulled into Ruby third and says he'd be sticking around for 4 to 6 hours.
Nothing about this team that looks like they need to be 24 now.
The elder Seavey pulls two dogs out of the sled that he's rested along the way, on a schedule he described as secret. The next two mushers were cagey as well. Nicholas Petit arrived fourth, wearing a polar bear ruff from Kotzebue. He was put off by the steep hills and sharp turns getting back onto the trail, and didn't think it was a safe idea to attempt with a supercharged dog team. Arriving in fifth, Jor Elsom was less committal about his plans. Elsom was relatively upbeat, saying he got a relaxing hour-long nap in while the sun was up and felt wide awake.
You know, it's always good to declare you ate, because if I was to oversleep now, nothing bad would happen. So, we'll see.
As the sleepless nights add up, mushers will focus on avoiding mistakes and exploiting any that they see from their competitors. For KNOM News, I'm Ben Matheson in Ruby.
So, as you heard, Ben filed that story from Ruby. But earlier in the day yesterday, he was in Tanana, and he caught up with Alan Moore, who is running toward the middle of the pack, and he's got a little different take than those running up front.
What's on my mind is I want to go about halfway to Ruby and camp for a few hours and then head on to Ruby. I've got 16 dogs, which is good. I've got some young ones, I got some old ones, and I got some crippled ones is what I usually tell the press, just meaning that they've been injured probably in the last month, and hopefully their injuries don't reoccur, and if they don't, then it'll be a good, smooth race. And so far, so good.
Mm-hmm. How long were you here in Tanana?
8 hours. I'm taking my eight here, mm-hmm. and I'm waiting about 5-10 more minutes, and then I can head on down the river.
Mm-hmm. So we're getting to the point in the race where we're going to see some people take their eights first and some people looking to do their 24s. And just in general, what does a 24-hour break accomplish, and what does it take for you to have a successful 24-hour break?
Well, that's strategically, especially for the leaders, it means a lot where to take it. But you have to read your dogs, too. I have several that the most they've done is a 100-mile race. That's all in their whole life. So taking my eight a little bit earlier, I'm trying to ease them into this 1,000 thing, and that's why I'm doing my eight early. A lot of the front runners, they're choosing to do their eights on down the trail. Some may do it in Ruby. Some may wait all the way to Caltag. But I'm not in the leader group, so and I got a lot of young ones. So I can only do what they can do.
Now, whether it's an old team or young, veterans, rookies, keeping an eye on the dogs is obviously at the top of the mushers' priority list, but it also factors in for those covering the race. Ben had a chance to talk to a guy named Bruce Lee. He works for the Iditarod Insider, and he proceeded to drop some knowledge on us.
For me, because I was a dog musher for so long, for me, I'm probably 90% dogs. My eyes are totally on the dogs. Like, as we stand here now, I see dog teams that are animated. You can, you know, hear them interested in the musher. If when they're hooking up, we have them focused on the musher, not doing the 1,000-mile stare. Like, I'd rather stay here and sleep. That's a team with energy. I primarily look if they have good stools, if they're animated, and primarily, are they eating and drinking? Because if the dogs don't have fuel, they don't go. So that, to me, is always the key to where a dog team is amongst their competitors. Every musher will say, yeah, they're doing good, but if they're not eating, those little subtleties of being tuned into the dogs tell you really what's going on.
Mm-hmm. So if you see frozen food left over in some of these dishes, does that say anything?
It can, but then again, you've got to be there to see, was that their first meal or their second meal? So a lot of times mushers will feed them one meal, and then they'll take one more out there later, and the dogs may only eat part of it, and that's just kind of like topping off the tank. So, but that can be an indicator, but you really kind of have to be there when they feed. And then the other 10% is the musher. Are they up? Are they down? You always hear mushers say, the dogs reflect off of them. And it also goes the other way, though we hate to admit it. The musher's attitude reflects off the dogs. If your dogs are up, it's impossible to be down. But if you see little things, it does kind of start to wear on you. Like, you're worried about them, just like a parent worries about a kid. You know, if they're a little off, they're sick, if they're not doing well at school or they're having problems, you're a little focused on that. So I read the mushers a little bit, but it's about the dogs, it's about the dogs, it's about the dogs.
All right, so obviously the race is about the dogs, watching the dogs, finding out what they're doing, how they're feeling, are they ready to go? But right now, let's switch over to something a little more musher-centric. We've talked about it a lot in past episodes, but we're going to come back because it's still an issue. The new controversial rule change that allows mushers to carry two-way communications devices like cell phones or satellite phones. Zach has talked to a bunch of mushers about this change, and many competitors, both young and old, think the presence of technology in the race goes against the spirit of the Iditarod. Let's take a listen to the story he sent in the other day.
Kasilov musher Monica Zappa has a reputation for being outspoken, and she didn't mince words at the ceremonial start about why she's boycotting the two-way communication rule.
Because it's pointless. My cell phone would be dead in 2 seconds in the cold anyway. There's no service on the trail, and it's a really lame rule.
The change is to language in rule number 35, governing electronic devices. Communicators can be brought along and used, though not for any media purposes. Paul Gebhardt sits on the Iditarod's board of directors and says he won't be bringing any kind of phone.
I don't like it. I got nobody I really want to talk to when I'm out there. It's just my dogs and me. And that's what I think the spirit of the race is about. And I voted personally against the two-way communication device, and most of the mushers agree with me.
A lot of racers say the technology is not only cumbersome, but could prove to be a distraction. Norwegian Jor Olsen thinks it also opens up the possibility of getting mentally derailed at a time when psychological fortitude is crucial.
People can send you text messages that you receive and you have no control what they're saying to you. And they could say thing that's going to benefit me, or they could say thing that's going to mess up my day. So,
not everyone is against the change, though. And some like it for the very reason that others are dismissive. Wade Mars is bringing both a satellite and cell phone, and says while communication can't be part of his race strategy, it'll be a boost to check in with his girlfriend at tough points along the trail.
I do my best thinking on my own and not with any pressure, so I'm definitely not looking to find any advice or anything like that from it, but you know, be able to call Sophie and say hi and tell her I love her and things like that, you know, that'll be nice.
While racers still aren't allowed to accept any outside help, it's unclear how that prohibition can be monitored and enforced when it comes to calls or communication. There's lingering ambiguity about what is and isn't allowed under the rule change, even among some of the race's most experienced veterans. Past champion Mitch Seavey is bringing a cell phone, somewhat reluctantly, and he says for those mushers gunning for a first-place finish, there's no use not seizing every available tool to gain an edge.
I didn't make the rule. I wish the rule wasn't there. But if they're going to have that device allowed, and it isn't just cell phones, it's any two-way communication, so remember, it's not limited by cell coverage, then I would be foolish to not participate in that, although honestly, we're at the starting line and I'm not quite sure yet what we're allowed to use them for and what we're not.
The change was spurred by safety concerns after last year's race when an intoxicated snow machiner attacked two mushers on a remote stretch of trail. Defenders of the rule say that with the technology available, there's no longer a good reason not to have an extra security option available for those who want it. One of the racers attacked was Ali Zirkel, who, with the new rule in place, would be able to call race officials for help if something similar ever happened. But few mushers cite safety in their decision on whether or not to bring a device. Zirkel's partner, Alan Moore, won't be carrying one, but he is bringing another safety precaution.
I got a flare gun. I don't know if that counts. To scare off moose or bad people or whatever.
Reporting from the Iditarod Trail, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
So this particular rule change has not been a real popular one among those competing in this year's race. We did have a question come in from a listener yesterday that's a bit of a follow-up to Zach's story, so I tossed it his way.
Denise Carl and Juno, I'm wondering about who the folks are that make the rules for the Iditarod. Thus far in the podcast, it seemed that many of the rules are contentious to the mushers, and therefore, I'm wondering, who makes these rules?
Hi, Denise. Good question. Rules are made or passed or modified by the Iditarod's board of directors. It's a body of 9 people. They're all men, 10 if you count the member emeritus, Joe Reddington Sr., father of the last great race. And they meet and discuss rule changes. They're put up for a vote, and testimony is taken or offered by mushers, but it's those 9 members, the board members of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Committee.
Now, Zach, sounds like he was pretty exhausted by the time he recorded that answer last night. He sent it to me about 1:30 this morning. That's a pretty long day of work out on the trail. So in that story of Zach's we listened to a minute ago, we've heard from a lot of those mushers before in previous episodes, but we're going to kind of use it as a jumping off point for some more discussion that came up during Alaska Public Media's call-in show, Talk of Alaska. We were talking about the Iditarod with a couple of mushers who are not going to be out on the Iditarod Trail this year. There are some pretty notable Iditarod competitors, Lisbeth Norris, who's a race veteran, and the Iditarod legend, Libby Riddles.
Well, if everybody has the same thing going on, then it's equal for everybody, but personally, I think it's crazy. I don't think it's really in the spirit of the Iditarod, is my own feeling, but then I'm not queen of the world and I didn't make the rule. So, you know, I'm just now, you know, just watching to see this year, you know, how it plays out. And, you know, ideally they're not supposed to have coaching with the phone, but how are you ever going to oversee that? Like, just to know where everybody else is on the trail by having somebody with a GPS tracker call and tell you, you know, that part I don't like. The part that might be fun, though, is getting information from people who are getting the calls and then getting a little bit more insight of what's going on out there. I've also heard that reception's bad. How are they going to charge these things? Yada, yada. So I'm just like everybody else, just kind of waiting to see how it'll shake out.
Elizabeth, what are your thoughts about this?
I'm not a fan of the rule change. I think it's a completely unenforceable rule. And, I mean, of course, there's a lot of aspects to races and competitions that rely on sportsmanly-like conduct. But with these cell phones, there is no way to ensure whether someone is not being coached. I think the arguments against cell phones in that, oh, there's poor reception or you can't charge them, I think that comes from a generation that doesn't have a great grasp on technology and the satellite capabilities of phones, and you can charge your phone with your headlight. Like, I have a USB charger for my my headlight. Like, you can keep a device charged all the way down the trail. You can have a sat phone addition to your iPhone to, like, enable it to be a satellite phone. I liked the CV's idea that they put forth of allowing mushers to carry a sat phone in case of emergency, but have it wrapped up in some sort of seal.
Sealed. Yeah.
Like a sealed safety thing. But it's also can provide a false sense of security, you know, the same with the button on the trackers, the help
yep.
button. I mean, you cannot guarantee that someone is going to be able to come out and rescue you at any point. Like, it could take hours and hours for someone to be able to reach wherever you are. Like, it's not you need to be able to take care of yourself out there.
Lisbeth raised a pretty interesting and obviously very valid point. I've heard mushers say over the years that often the most brutal test along the Iditarod route is that run up the coast. You just see some ridiculous weather in that notion, and understanding that if you're going to be there, you need to know how to take care of yourself is important, because even if you do have a satellite phone or a GPS tracker, it doesn't necessarily mean somebody will be able to come out and help you. And now, a rather relevant story was brought up during the show about one of Libby's experiences on the coast. Let's take a listen to that clip from the show.
Yes, let's hear that story about the big snowstorm.
It was more just being holed up in my sled bag, which they used to have sleds big enough that you could actually get inside of them and sleep for the night. And, you know, I was racing from the village of Teller up there. And hi, everybody in Teller, if anybody's listening. And we used to go out in storms on purpose just to practice for Iditarod. And it was still scary, and I still could have died out there. But basically, I was leading the race, and got stuck in a snowstorm out in Norton Sound on the sea ice, and we didn't make it all the way across, so the dogs tucked into the snow and got covered up with snow and were nicely insulated, and I got into my sled bag and spent the night out there and was out in the ice like 24 hours, but... you know, you have to know how to do that stuff. It's sometimes too stormy for somebody to come and rescue you. So part of the idea of the Iditarod is you have to know how to take care of yourself. But
now, that in itself just sounds crazy to me, but apparently the full story was even crazier than that. Another listener brought it up.
I think you are sort of undertelling your story of being out on the ice and climbing into your sled bag. What I recall was after you got in there finally and got zipped in, that you realized you were sweaty to the bone, and you unzipped everything and took off all your clothes and changed into dry clothes inside the sled bag.
Yeah, well, that's the long version of the story. But, you know, I found out camping. One time my Norwegian friends were visiting me up in Teller, and we did a three-dog team trip from Teller to Nome. And that country between there is tougher than anything on the Iditarod, if you ask me. And we got all sweated up because there was no snow on the road, and I tried to sleep that night in wet clothes, and I didn't almost die, but I was so uncomfortable I kind of wished I did. But so I learned my lesson, and so then I was out on the race, and I knew I had to do that because same kind of thing. I had to be walking up in front of the dogs to find the trail and the marker and then walk back, you know, and so I was kind of sweated up, and, you know, that's a good way to die out there. So if it takes 2 hours to get dry clothes on, that's what it takes. Well, at least I was smart and had dry clothes. So anyway, thanks,
Joan.
There you go.
That's the real grit. That's the real grit there.
Now, in my years of tracking the Iditarod, which I'll admit it's only about 5 or 6, Libby's story is probably among the most harrowing that I've heard personally, but it's no secret that the race carries some inherent dangers with it. It's a 1,000-mile sled dog race through some extremely remote terrain, just a musher and their dog team. A lot of things can happen. We do have a couple more listener questions that delve into that subject a little bit more. Let's hear one.
Hi, my name is Sophie. I'm a 4th grader from Wisconsin. I was wondering, what are some dangers at running at night?
And I think we adequately established this in yesterday's episode. Zach is the guy with all of the answers, so I asked him to take a stab at answering.
There are a couple. First of all, it's really cold. And this isn't a danger so much as a challenge, because mushers totally know and prepare for how to dress and how to deal with these conditions. That said, at 30 or 40 below, for hours at a time, that can be kind of tricky. This time of year in Alaska, the sun is starting to come back, and when it's overhead during the day, temperatures can warm up quite a bit. 0 degrees might sound cold, but with sun bouncing off the snow and hitting you directly, it can actually be kind of cozy. Overnight, after the sun sets, that's when it gets really cold. Second, sleep deprivation. Like, when your mind starts to break down a little bit because you haven't slept in a while, that's another risk. In the dark, it's hard to see stuff, there's not as much stimulation, and you're just not getting to see or feel energy from the landscape around you. It's dark, and you really just have your dogs underneath a headlamp to know where you're going. So those are some of the risks of running at night.
And we do have one more question today, my classmate of the last listener, in fact. Let's hear it.
Hi, my name is Shiloh. I'm a 4th grader from Wisconsin. I have a question for you. Is it common to see a musher fall off the sled?
And let's take it back to Zach, because apparently he knows some things.
Yes. Balancing on a sled is one of the parts of mushing that you get better and better at the more you do it. But terrain is difficult, and especially on turns, if your sled's not balanced right and you're going a little bit too fast, you can fall off. All mushers fall, and it's just part of getting better. But it can cause a lot of problems. For one, sometimes mushers get hurt. Two, if you fall and you lose hold of your sled, the team sometimes keeps going, and even when you yell, they might not stop as quickly as you want them to, or at all, frankly. And you see this later on in the race when mushers get to the sea ice or to parts of the river where there might not be as much snow, but on icy conditions, sometimes with wind and without snow to hold the sled in place, a lot of mushers can slide forwards and backwards. They might not fall off, but they've really got to hang on.
Both Sophie and Shiloh are from the same elementary school class in Wisconsin. We'll actually be hearing more from that class in a later episode when we talk about how the Iditarod is incorporated into classroom curriculums all over the place. And it just so happens that their class also produces an Iditarod podcast that I would highly recommend checking out. It's called Ikitapod. You can find it on iTunes, and I'll throw a link to it on our website at alaskapublic.org. So the questions you've heard in this episode, they did all come from listeners. If you do have a question of your own about the race, please send it our way. You can email them to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. Better yet, record yourself on a smartphone and email us. You can use a voice recorder or a memo app. Almost all phones have these. Introduce yourself, tell us where you're from, and ask away. And that is all we have for today. Thanks to Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes and K&M Radio's Ben Matheson for all the long hours they're putting in out on the trail. We are in the midst of our daily episodes, so if you like what you hear, you can tune in every day during the race. And to make that a little bit easier, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher or listen on alaskapublic.org. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras, and I'm Josh Edge. Goodbye.
As far as where the race really starts, I really think the race starts to win at Cowtag. Up until that point, it's kind of more of a, it's a fast, very fast-paced camping trip, but it's about maintenance and taking care of your dogs.